You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, we're talking with Eileen Miles in East Village now. Eileen, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Hey, pleasure, Brainerd.
It's great that you're in East Village. I know you're on, I think it's 3rd Street. I was in the living there for a while, and as so many people have, as we were saying off record. But that street in particular has changed a lot. Isn't that the street that the Hells Angels had the building on, or is that 4th?
It is that street, and that's what it's famous for. It's like anybody knows the block or doesn't know the block, you just say Hells Angels, and they're like, oh, that block. And then, are they still there? And then you have a little conversation about the Hells Angels, you know. At a certain time, there was like, and the Catholic Worker is also
right
on 3rd Street. Well, actually, not the Catholic Worker, the Mary House, which is their women's shelter. And then for years, there was something called the Good Humor, I think it was the Good Humor Man was there, which was great because I thought it's amazing that we had, you know, the Catholic Worker, the Hells Angels, and the Good Humor Man. But it's not. I think that's been replaced by NYU Law School, which is less perfect.
Right. And you're also in Marfa part of the year. Is this right?
Yeah. Erratically, you know, it's like I bought a house there last spring and then didn't start living there until January because I was on book tour. But now it's like, you know, part of every month I go there. It's definitely my go-to place for working because even though there's a small community and there's an art world there and there's literary things, you basically can really hide in Marfa or go out. So it's sort of a perfect place for writing. And my dog is there.
Hmm. Well, Marfa's supposed to be a great place, right? I've never been there. I interviewed Rainer Judd a while ago, and she was talking about, you know, how amazing it is, and as a whole town, as a whole sort of almost collective artwork. Is your experience of it kind of like that, or is it just this kind of getaway, or is it really an aesthetic, physically aesthetic experience that's seen?
Oh, no, it is, because it's like everything, I mean, the town, I mean, it's a small biracial West Texas town that's pretty close to the mountains, and so it's physically beautiful, but you know, it's sort of like it's because of the Judd thing and Chinati Foundation and so on. It's sort of like there's just enough self-consciousness there that it's like things are either kind of retro and decaying or retro and preserved, and then there's this sort of Judd aesthetic imposed upon it. So it's really visually kind of, you kind of feel like it's you being surprised all the time, but generally it's somebody else has fixed to preserve that thing for you. So it's a very funny, beautiful place. You know, it's like, it's a bit of a, you know, it's sometimes it seems like a bit of a ghost town. And yet it's sort of like, you know, it's got this aesthetic effect, you know, it's kind of minimalism in the desert in a weird way, you know?
Well, then it changes how you see New York, too, right? I think it was in on Twitter you said, coming back to New York feels like I'm getting into my crate. New York must feel suddenly different coming back from Marfa, I would imagine.
Well, one of the things is that, you know, if you have an apartment, I've had this apartment since 1977. So, I mean, I could have gotten a loft in 1977, but I didn't. So I'm on a studio, you know, I'm in like a kind of essentially a 20-something, like a punk 20-something apartment. So it's like a little railroad car. You know, and though I don't live in a mansion in Marfa, I live in a house, and I wander around, and I could move in all these different spots. So it's just kind of, it's very compressed coming back to New York, and then of course this explosion of activity and people. So, you know, as always, New York is outside to me. You know, and at home is sort of a little kind of hermitage. You know,
right. Well, let's talk about your work, and I'm going to ask you to read some poems too that I know. You have a few of there, but in the last year, really, it's been about a year that I was working on this interview with you. And a year ago, when I was thinking of interviewing you, it was before maybe Transparent was in progress. The, you know, the Amazon original television show, for people who don't know,
uh-huh,
it, that you have had a cameo in and have a character modeled after, and also the reissue of Chelsea Girls, right? A number of things. 2015 was a pretty big year for you, or am I incorrect?
Yeah, no, it's been, yeah, it was kind of amazing.
That must be wonderful, right? I mean, it's not that you didn't have attention all along, and that you weren't a well-known figure and enmeshed in the literary scene and art scene of New York, but I guess the new book and Transparent changed things somehow. I mean, obviously there was a lot of press, but how else has it changed things, or what was so wonderful about that?
Well, I mean, part of the thing that's odd is that, like you say, it's sort of like I wasn't exactly unknown, but now often the press is about unknown poet makes big, you know? So it's kind of like, it's like you can't be bigger without being made smaller too. And that seems always very funny and sort of untrue. But I think the coolest thing really is that a poet life is suddenly currency again. You know, it's sort of like, you know, there's always been, like, Allen Ginsberg was the famous poet when I was growing up, and increasingly I feel like I might be the famous poet at this moment, you know? And it's just, you know, it is this kind of combustion of events, like publishing and television, you know? And I think nobody has ever become known as a poet through television, so I think that's really wonderful. And I'm the last poet in the world to be antithetical to television. I mean, I both loved, you know, I'm 66 years old, so I grew up in the golden age of TV when it was new, and it was really great in the 50s and 60s, you know. And now I think TV is a major art form, and we're in sort of a Dickens moment for TV with the serial novel of television happening. So, you know, I think that I've just happened to have been embedded in the coolest art form today, you know. So I'm loving it. But it's just, you know, it just means that I get so many more offers for gigs, and I don't know, you know, I'm just, obviously I'm financially, you know, it's America, you can't help doing better financially too, and I'm sort of busier and having to think differently about my time, but as who I am, it's like it's too late to ruin or change me, you know. I mean, I'm one poet, you know, and I'm writing these books, and assuming that I don't want to write a celebrity book, and I don't want to write a celebrity book, I just keep doing my work. So it's just, it's more of the same in a way, and I just have to work a little harder to protect what I need, which is a certain amount of, you know, quiet and aloneness and you know,
right,
a personal life of some sort, you know, which means that the choices I make rather than the choices somebody else makes for me, you know.
You know, it's interesting you were talking about television being at a Dickens moment. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about that, because Transparent is such an unusual production, but it's not just Transparent. There's that's a great show, and I've been watching that really closely, but there's mm-hmm. a whole bunch of shows on television with this whole kind of new concept, which I know you know, and everyone knows most likely that's listening, this idea of Amazon and Netflix originals, where instead of episodes and commercials, we do have something left over, that there are still episodes, but suddenly the whole thing's released at once, and it just seems like a completely different form almost, as well as other things can happen. There can be, you know, nudity or language that wasn't allowed on TV. What do you see happening right now in television? And I would imagine, as you've as I saw in one interview, talked about, you know, maybe you'd be interested in even writing for television. What do you think is happening now? Because it does seem like an incredible moment creatively.
Well, I think it has a funny way of like being right next to the explosion of social media too, in which everybody has a certain kind of sense, self-consciousness about the way they live, and it's sort of circled with observation and surveillance. But also, and I think all these TV shows suggest that any one of our lives could, you know, spur a show too. So I think there's just a kind of, I think they all create a different kind of living in which everybody in some way views themselves as a character potentially in an episode, you know, like having heightened events, which then will be viewed by everybody else. You know what I mean? Like, I think it's sort of like the idea of a discrete life is sort of losing its boundaries in a certain way. And I think these shows are contributing to that. You know, it's like you might be in the middle of something and you think, wow, this would be an amazing show, or this reality, this social world hasn't been commodified or viewed yet. You know, so I think that it creates to this general funniness about living that we're all participating in now, you know.
Well, that's interesting, because it's I mean, what I understand you're saying is it's not just, you know, about a kind of new form, but as you're saying, the collision of social media at the same time, there's a kind of, maybe exhibitionism is the wrong word, you know, when we send out tweets or updates or Instagram images, we're sharing, right, is the word that's being used more, but it seems that, as you're saying, that can actually make us more self-conscious or conscious in a good way about aspects of our lives that perhaps would be of interest to other people. As you're saying now, certain things that are happening in Transparent are tapping into what's happening with gender studies or gender politics and all kinds of things at this moment. So I would imagine that right, there's all kinds of other things that we could be tapping into.
Mm-hmm. I think people are much more partisan about their lives. I think people see their lives as more symbolic in a way. And it also creates a furor, I think, about the election we're coming into, too, because people's candidates have become their avatars. And it's sort of like everybody has the freedom to write dialogue around Bernie, around Hillary, around Trump, you know, and it's just like this, just a different investment and just a wash of citizen discourse, if you want to call it that, you know, but it's like, it's rabid, you know, it's just like everybody,
right.
Like it's very reactive too.
Well, and it's not so much a discourse. It seems like it's more preaching to the converted. I mean, I noticed you had said, and I think it was, Twitter that there's a, you know, video showing purporting Hillary to be lying. And it's really a piece of propaganda from, you know, Tea Party member, and people are, you know, showing this like, you know, this is, I don't know, CNN or something with a
really above
board kind of interview.
Yeah. I mean, it's like Hillary is so interesting because it's like, why is it that a woman is becoming the most kind of seen, the most distributed, the most maligned political figure we've had in a long time? I mean, it's just like, I don't know. I mean, I'm actually in a state of confusion about it. Yet I wrote something on BuzzFeed yesterday, you know, about her. You know, because I am a Hillary supporter because I, for a variety of reasons, a big one being a female. Why not? Let's do it. You know, and we have a reasonable candidate. You know, and I think that, you know, I have questions about Sanders and how reasonable he is. You know, but there's so much history. And there's so much fact and there's so much information and there's so much, again, like, you know, kind of partisan utilizing all that information in this way to create strings of diatribe. You know, it's sort of like, it's just like, I can't possibly know what everything that Hillary ever did or was part of in her political life, you know, but everybody else purports to know what it is, you know.
Right, right.
It's like, it's a live one.
It sure is. It sure is. And, you know, I'm a Hillary supporter too, and it looks, you know, I think it's looking better for her, but it's hard to even gauge how that's going because we're all getting, I'm getting information on my Facebook feed that's, you know, that also seems to make things look different than they are, that Bernie is doing so well when that's also not quite the case because of all the kind of, I don't know, videos that and comments that people are sharing that are often inaccurate.
Right.
Okay, let's move on to your work, though. It's
okay. Good.
I'm excited to talk about your poetry and to hear some of it. So, what are we listening to first? What are you reading to us now?
Why don't I read? I'm going to read a poem called "What Tree Am I Leaving?" And it's from this new book, My Selected. I Must Be Living Twice. So it's like you know. It's a new and selected, so there's some new, and this is, you know, and it's funny, of course, the new isn't that new by now, you know, but so it's newish, but it's the newest of the, you know, old new.
Okay, and it's because
yeah.
The publisher, you mean, because when the publisher reissued and used those poems, those were already written earlier than that, and that was about a year or so ago.
Like, yeah, so it's sort of like the front of it, you know, the front of what's now the back is the book, you know, book comes, gets published and it's always behind you. So,
right.
So here goes, it's, what tree am I waiting? That whole part of the world where I won't go anymore, that whole separation that I won't feel, high in this house, in this hemisphere and this artificial light that is artificial in the earliest morning, dark, in pages and pens and an unfamiliar bed in the foot curl. Furniture, each rumble when morning comes and it's still morning and it's still night. I married a dead girl. We were born in her bloom. Remember that fat bumblebee landed on a lamp? I opened the doors and I forgot and the house got colder and colder. Where is this house? The seam between boards merely gains my attention. It's dark and thin. I monitor each situation, my bladder growing full. Climb down, climb up. What tree am I waiting? My whole life and weather waiting for my raft. I'll fly to another island. I'll take a train. Already I know it will hurt. This is the hurt country. I came here to hold the hurt like a bird, like a tree. Traffic has rings. We watch it whirl around, damaging our night. Great continents hold the feelings and the ages. What is mine? Going blind. Great masses of them not going home. The country drew a line because of memory. One said, I feel my heart race ahead. In eternity there is this ache. There is this wakefulness.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I feel like I have to pause appropriately afterwards, like between movements, you know, classical piece or something. But
yeah, it's funny. There's a big, loud pause after a poem. And it's the thing when you're reading in front of people is that you make a face. You know, you have to struggle not to make a face when you finish a poem. But it's really great on a recording. You don't have to worry about that. You just shut up. Mm-hmm.
So that's a very beautiful poem. That was one you wrote about a year ago. That's included in the new volume, and touches on, you know, and it's always hard for me to try to kind of talk about exactly how I'm seeing it, but it seems to touch on themes that you've worked on a lot. I mean, it not only seems kind of very sensual and physical and visual, but also a sense of kind of longing, heartache, and something about reaching into the future or past is something that I see in your work and seems to be in that one as well. Do I seem to be really off the mark or?
No, that's great. No, that's terrific. Yeah, I mean, time is the great subject, you know, and then such a thing as, you know, feeling or heart, you know, it's often, I feel like, the material of what I'm working on, and it's like, how can you make feeling be a kind of travel, even in a small way, you know? And it's like it's like you're traveling in the moments inside of the poem, which is just a little capsule of this particular emotional event you're always describing. So I always wanted there to be a little bit of a sense, perhaps, of knowing what's going on without too much, you know. So it's like it's animated, but it sort of is still a thing, just being there, kind of holding your attention for a few minutes, you know.
Okay, can you read us another one?
Yeah, sure. Okay, this one is called, and this is like from the 90s, and it's called Shh. I don't think I can afford the time to not sit right down and write a poem about the heavy-lidded white rose I hold in my hand. I think of snow. A winter night in Boston, drunken waitress stumble on a bus that careens through Somerville, the end of the line where I was born, an old man shaking me. He could have been my dad. You need a ride? Wait, he said. This flower is so heavy in my hand. He drove me home in his old blue Dodge, a thermos next to me, cigarette packs on the dash, so quiet like Boston is quiet, Boston in the snow. It's New York. Plates are clattering on St. Mark's Place. Should I call you? Can I go home now and work with this undelivered message in my fingertips? It's summer. I love you. I'm surrounded by snow.
Thank you for that one. It's such a beautiful image, being surrounded by snow and to leave it that way. There's this, you've written so many works, and, you know, as you were saying in a way at the beginning of this conversation about, you know, the poet's life or the poet and you, you know, getting this kind of attention lately in all ways, you know, including Transparent. There are also poems that seem to get, you know, more attention than others or become even even catalysts for certain kinds of dialogue. How do you feel about that? I mean, I guess what I'm trying to say is I'm thinking about the poem about Robert Lowell's death or others that seem to create a kind of pushback or dialogue about what other people think about them. Is that something you reach for or happens often? You know, in art, when we talk about visual art, often artists may make things, maybe not often, but if they make things that are offensive to people, that upset sensibilities, you know, in some cases, that's what art's for, right? That's what poetry's for. Do you feel that happens, and when that does, is it intentional?
Well, no. I mean, I think the thing that's so interesting is it's sort of like you know, you write these things and you throw them out and you have no idea, you know, you kind of have no idea what's going to happen. But, you know, I mean, like I have a poem called An American Poem, and that's my Kennedy poem. And, I mean, when I wrote it, I mean, it was just like I had the idea for the poem before I wrote it, which is really rare, you know, usually. But it was in the 80s, and it was the height of performance art in New York, and I was starting to move into those circles. And, you know, I was talking to somebody on the phone, or no, I was talking to, I can't remember where we were talking, and somebody I was dating, and I started to lie about my class background and tell her I was rich. And I could see that she was believing it, and so I just elaborated, and I wound up claiming to be a candidate. Well, I started to do it, and then in my head I had the light bulb thing, and I realized that I could write this poem about being a Kennedy. I could be a secret Kennedy. And so I had this poem, and that probably is, you know, kind of a hit poem for me. But
that was also performed at PS122, wasn't it? So it became more of a, I mean, you know, that was at the time, and just correct me if I'm wrong, but there was, PS122 is doing performances and all kinds of things. Poets are doing readings, but poet doing kind of performances, that is a, where the reading itself is dynamic.
Right.
Was something a little bit new then, wasn't it? Especially at PS122.
And it created a different opportunity to read your work, because it seemed, I mean, as part of the thing of being a poet is that you have to constantly you have to tinker with the notion of who you are, what you're doing, and who's listening, you know? And so the 80s with performance art was just a whole new world, you know? And so entering it meant that different people who maybe weren't so interested in poetry, I mean, it's just like, in a way, on a certain level, a poem, a performance, what's the difference? I mean, you look at the work that Karen Finley got so well known for in the 80s, and some of it seemed like a poem if you looked at it on the page, you know, but it was like she performed it in this elaborate way, you know. But then at the same time, like a poem that I would write, I wrote a poem in the 80s called Peanut Butter, and it was kind of a love poem, and it was in my book Not Me, which Semiotext published, and that in itself, like Semiotext published French theory largely. So I was the first poet they published, and that put me in a whole different, and that was, you know, just through friendship, I knew those people, so they knew my work, so they published it, which was sort of a radical act. But weirdly, Poetry Magazine, when it had a website, just put this one poem of mine, Peanut Butter, you know, put it up or put it out or however, you know, I mean, they just published it out on the internet on their website. And it just suddenly became like a new hit poem, like a bunch of people who knew and ever knew my work loved this poem. So the thing that's weird about poems is that it's sort of like that term that we got from chaos or math, a singularity, like a poem can be a singularity. For some reason, this marble rolls down this hill for everybody. And you don't know why. It was just like, what emotionally does this poem perform that somehow clicks with so many people? So that part, I mean, the Kennedy one, I thought, I know this is like timely, and it gave me an opportunity to talk about, you know, the homeless in New York in the 80s and my friends dying of AIDS. And you know, and I was entitled to make those statements because I was a Kennedy, in a way that as a Miles, I did not, you know. But Peanut Butter, I have no clue. You know, it just somehow or other became the poem that brought a lot of people to me. So there's an uncanny part that you just don't really understand why this is happening, but it's obviously cool. And my work, you know, my work is sort of both mysterious and very available. It's very direct and it's slightly indirect. So I think it kind of hits a public-private line for people too.
Well, that's very interesting because, right, there's that, and also, as you're saying, these kind of singularities, poems, just like artworks, can be these kind of hits, so to speak, that become kind of embedded in everyone's minds or memory. That you know, so sometimes overshadow so much else. Like there was an artist that I talked to. And I don't know if you know this image, but it was a very famous image of Imogen Cunningham, the photographer, when she was 90, and she's on one side of a tree, and then this model, Twinka, is fully nude on the other side of the tree, and it looks kind of like she's some kind of a wood nymph or something looking at old age or aging or something. And Judy Dater, the photographer who took that, that was kind of a one-off image that she just did one day, and, you know, she's putting together a monograph, and she said the one picture I'm leaving out is that one because it's overshadowed everything I've done in the last 30 years.
Yeah.
Which I guess can happen too, but that's not really the case with some of the poems that we're talking about. It's the sort of singularities that have become very big, like Peanut Butter or American Poem.
Yeah. Well, the thing that's fun too is when you go on tour, no matter how much I think, tonight I feel like doing sort of a greatest hits reading. I'm going to do the Robert Lowell poem. I'm going to do all these poems and stuff. And it's just like a whole bunch of people in the room. I mean, poet fame is always relative. And so no matter how many of my best known poems I piled together, there's always going to be somebody who's going to walk up. I mean, they love to say, "It's so funny, I've never heard about you till tonight." You know what I mean? Like, people are very excited to tell you that they've never heard of you. I think, why would I? You know, but they don't know these poems at all, and so you've actually just handed your work freshly to someone, and that's kind of a funny coincidence and a pleasure, you know?
Mm. Yeah, it is. So what are you reading us next? I'd love to hear another poem. I mean, in a way, now that we've been talking about this, I'd like to hear greatest hits too. American Poem, I was just, and please just read whatever you want, but I was just talking about that to my 14-year-old son this morning on the way to school, trying to explain to him that particular work, and then I thought, I'm ruining it, paraphrasing it. I'll show it to you later. But
so are you proposing I read that or something else?
I'm proposing to read that if you want to, or and or something else.
Okay. Well, let me read something else, and then I'm going to read that. I'm going to follow one with the other. How's that?
Okay, that sounds good.
Okay. This one is called Writing. I can connect any two things. That's God. Teeny piece of Band-Aid, little folded piece of Band-Aid. I ran to the bathroom to see my face. Sometimes I don't want to see my face in the mirror. Sometimes I can't bear my thoughts. Sometimes I can't do anything, but that's okay. Band-Aid, book, God. That's right. Now, this is an American poem.
And let me just ask you one thing about this American poem. Was that... I know you ran for president, you know, this write-in and did a tour on that. Was that around the time you were writing this poem? It was. Okay.
No, it wasn't. It was I wrote the poem probably in 86, so that was like 6 years before. But I used when I was – but the book came out in 91, and so the book was in the time – the book came out at the time of the presidential the campaign. So – I use the poem and the book as my sort of, you know, how candidates always have a book, you know, so Not Me became my campaign book, which was funny. So this is an American poem. I was born in Boston in 1949. I never wanted this fact to be known. In fact, I've spent the better half of my adult life trying to sweep my early years under the carpet and have a life that was clearly just mine and independent of the historic fate of my family. Can you imagine what it was like to be one of them, to be built like them, to talk like them, to have the benefits of being born into such a wealthy and powerful American family? I went to the best schools. I had all kinds of tutors and trainers. I traveled widely, met the famous, the controversial, and the not-so-admirable. And I knew from a very early age that if there were ever any possibility of escaping the collective fate of this famous Boston family, I would take that route, and I have. I hopped on an Amtrak to New York in the early 70s, and I guess you could say my hidden years began. I thought, well, I'll be a poet. What could be more foolish and obscure? I became a lesbian. Every woman in my family looks like a dyke, but it's really stepping off the flag when you become one. Well, holding this ignominious pose, I have seen and I have learned, and I'm beginning to think there's no escaping history. A woman I'm currently having an affair with said, you know, you look like a Kennedy. I felt the blood rising in my cheeks. People have always laughed at my Boston accent, confusing lodge for lodge, party for party. But when this unsuspecting woman evoked for the first time my family name, I knew the jig was up. Yes, I am. I am a Kennedy. My attempts to remain obscure have not served me well. Starting as a humble poet, I quickly climbed to the top of my profession, assuming a position of leadership and honor. It's right that a woman should call me out now. Yes, I am a Kennedy, and I await your orders. You are the new Americans. The homeless are wandering the streets of our nation's greatest city. Homeless men with AIDS are among them. Is that right that there's no homes for the homeless, that there's no free medical help for these men and women, that they get the message as they are dying that this is not their home? And how are your teeth today? Can you afford to fix them? How high is your rent? If art is the highest and most honest form of communication of our times, and the young artist is no longer able to move here and speak to her time. Yes, I could, but that was 15 years ago, and remember as I must. I am a Kennedy. Shouldn't we all be Kennedys? This nation's greatest city is home of the businessman, home of the rich artist, people with beautiful teeth who are not on the streets. What should we do about this dilemma? Listen, I have been educated. I have learned about Western civilization. Do you know what the message of Western civilization is? I am alone. Am I alone tonight? I don't think so. Am I the only one with bleeding gums tonight? Am I the only homosexual in this room tonight? Am I the only one whose friends have died or dying now? My art can't be supported until it is gigantic, bigger than everyone else's, confirming the audience's feeling that they are alone, that they alone are good, deserve to buy the tickets to see this art, are working, are healthy, should survive, and are normal. Are you normal tonight? Everyone here, are we all normal? It's not normal for me to be a Kennedy, but I am no longer ashamed, no longer alone. I'm not alone tonight because we are all Kennedys, and I am your president.
Thank you. Love that. I love that poem. So picking up on that, your book came out, and maybe let's just talk a little bit about why you decided to jump in the race of president and be a write-in. In one way, it just seems like a kind of brilliant platform, right, that lets everybody know not only is this possible, but there's a performative element to it, a kind of incredulous element to it. It's just there's something, to me, fascinating about it. Can you tell me a little bit about how that began and why that began and how you manage that kind of tour or yeah?
Well, you know, it's always, everything always happens on like a multiple number of levels, right? Like for me, I wrote this poem, you know, in 86, and what it gave me was an amazing politicizing experience as an artist. I mean, I memorized it. So I stood in front of people and I said it, and it felt great. I really liked being in that particular political bathtub. I was like, oh, this is a whole other way of being in the room. And I, you know, so I wanted that experience again, and I didn't know how to get it. You know, I mean, I kind of, it changed my poems in a certain way. But on the other hand, it never was so total. I mean, it was a single image in a way. It was like it took into account my accent and who I was and my history. And it kind of, you know, recast it as it took the me. I made it be another me, and it was a fictionalizing step in poetry for me that kind of changed the way I stood in the room. And so that was that, and then time passed, you know, and so by 92, I guess I had, you know, the poem made me be more of a performance artist, made me be a person who spoke differently to rooms and audiences and made me perform my work differently. So in a few years, I mean, so I went, I went as far as you could go with that in a certain way. And then in a few years, the political situation had gotten worse. I had seen the limits of, say, standing there memorizing texts because I still wasn't an actor. I still didn't have a way of being relaxed in my body in front of a room. I was still thinking a lot about the text as I recited it, which so had limitations, and I didn't want to take acting lessons and learn how to be a different kind of artist. So what I started to do is improvise, and I started to tell stories, which I was good at, and I realized that as a person talking, I moved my arms, I had a whole physicalization as me that I didn't have as me reciting a poem. So that was interesting. So I was doing that for a while, and that changed things because, again, I was looking at people, but I wasn't worrying about whether I would forget the poem or not because I was telling them something, and I was telling them something generally that was important to me that I wouldn't forget. So that was going on, and then you know, George Bush Sr. made the famous speech about the politically correct and freedom of speech, and the New York Times said that this would be the beginning of the 92 campaign trail, which this was in 1991, which is now so sweet in a way because we used to live in a time when newspapers would sort of propose that this particular message was the beginning of the election as opposed to this constant running for office that we have right now where the election never ends, really, that everybody is always potentially – it's almost like the – I would say the campaign is like another TV series. You know, it's another, you know, is this person going to have their own show? And will their show become our show? You know what I mean? Like this is merging of privacy and celebrity and politics now that we live with. But in 1991, that wasn't the case. And we had to like guess who might be the candidate, you know, and see if it would happen. And even newspapers had some power by that proposition. So I saw that starting to happen, and suddenly I realized that the artistic practice that I was currently engaged in, which was improvising, could produce a presidential campaign, you know. And so then I looked into the legality of it and understood that being a write-in candidate meant that I could just get running rather than collecting signatures for a year and a half. So that was, you know, that was how it began. And instantly it was just like I just decided that every single reading panel – you know, public event that I did would be a campaign op between then, which was April of 1991, and November of 1992. And so I just made this pledge to myself and let it encompass my political ideas and aspirations and, you know, everything. What I had, I started to use, you know, and my campaign, my platform was total disclosure, which meant that I would tell you what I was actually thinking. That I would write my own speeches. That I mean, I was your candidate in a way more thorough than anybody else could offer then or now probably, you know. Mm. So I ran against Bush. I ran against Bill Clinton, and I ran against Ross Perot. I ran against Lenora Fulani that you might remember, you know. And it was just it was a life changing experience because, you know, I was invited to. It's a little bit like, I have to say, the thing that's funny about what I'm going through now as a poet is that the first thing that's really been similar to the presidential campaign because it just changed the scale of who I was and what I did. So that there was an uncanniness to that moment in the same way that there's an uncanniness to this moment for me.
Well, that makes sense. It also sounds, it's fascinating to me to talk about how you were kind of in your body more with gestures because if I'm understanding that correctly, at that time, a lot of poets were starting to read without the paper in front of them, right? They were performing. They're looking at the audience and just reading. And, I mean, not reading. They've memorized their poem and they're talking. And that was a very different – I mean, for me, when I started seeing that, that was a very different way of listening to poetry or seeing it read.
Yeah. So actually,
that's what was happening. That sounds like it kind of resolved that at that time. But, I mean, I'm sorry. Yeah, go on.
Well, I mean, this was actually a few years before that, like the slam scene and everything hadn't quite hit. I mean, that was more like mid-90s. So this, in a way, I don't think this caused that, but this preceded that sort of.
Right. But also, you know, it's about a style of, which I think we should close on, although I'd love to also hear another poem of yours, but in terms of styles of reading, how a poet reads, you know, there seems to be so many different ways of doing that. I remember when I first heard Daniel Berrigan, the priest and poet, read, and I was in a conversation with him afterwards, or somehow it came up that I think it was Marianne Moore, somebody that he was whose poetry he loved was influential on him. And when I heard recordings of her read, it was exactly the way he was reading. He was using the same kind of pauses. I don't know. It was kind of incredible. And so, in a way, poetry, what you were just talking about, you're kind of finding your voice there. But yeah,
poetry styles are totally received. Yeah, they're always imitative of another performing style. So I have to admit, I mean, it's sort of like when I first started to read poetry publicly, I just had these feelings of whether I was entitled to be a poet or not, you know, and what it meant and who would I be. And, you know, there was that thing that we know, which is like poet voice, you know, which is very kind of like I am, you know, like it's like I can't even do it on my own poems. I can only do it these made up, you know, and the night was incredible, and
without any emotion, wasn't that based in this kind of, I don't know, Idaho Writers Workshop? It was this new kind of way of just being, I may be totally wrong with this, but that's what I remember, this kind of very monotone way of reading. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, it's a monotone with a cadence, so sometimes I feel like it's a white person doing black a little bit. You know, it's sort of like putting stresses on the poem that actually aren't there, you know. My thing that when I started to read, I just determined that I would read as closely to the way I spoke as possible. Like, I just wanted it to be, because one time when I was a kid, when I lived, like right after college, I lived in Cambridge in Central Square with my friends. It was my first apartment because I lived at home during college. I commuted. And so I lived in Central Square. I was young. I was depressed. And there was no cafe culture. There was like a chain called the Pewter Pot. And then there was Dunkin' Donuts. There just wasn't, if you wanted a cup of coffee, you would go to one place or the other, or a diner. So I remember going to like the Dunkin' Donuts in Central Square, and I was sitting there drinking some coffee. And suddenly this guy leaned over, and clearly he was crazy. And they just started to monologue at me. He just started to tell me something amazing, and I can't remember what he said, but what was really special was there was no segue. He just turned and he just started to say this stuff, and it was like, oh my God, you know. And it was, you know, and there was something about the pure madness and the ordinariness of it that struck me as like kind of a beautiful thing. And it was kind of like that I wanted to read my poems. It was just like, it's just kind of a strange breakout, in that it's not a breakout at all. Like, suddenly I'm telling, I mean, so it's always, when I'm reading, I'm always thinking, read it like Eileen, normalize, just, you know, like act as if you're talking to Brainerd, be as intimate, you know, as possible. And so it just gives the, whatever the poem holds, kind of a weirdly normalizing effect, you know, which is, I don't know, I guess that's my aesthetic.
I like that. Can you read one more poem to us before we go?
Yeah, sure. Let's see. This is called The Honey Bear. Billie Holiday was on the radio. I was standing in the kitchen smoking my cigarette of this pack I planned to finish tonight, last night of smoking youth. I made a cup of this funny kind of tea I've had hanging around, a little too sweet, an odd mix. My only impulse was to make it sweeter. Ivy Anderson was singing pretty late tonight in my very bright kitchen. I'm standing by the tub feeling a little older, nearly 30 in my very bright kitchen tonight. I'm not a bad-looking woman, I suppose. Oh, it's very quiet in my kitchen tonight. I'm squeezing this plastic honey bear, a noodle of honey dripping into the odd sweet tea. It's pretty late. Honey Bear's cover was loose, and somehow honey dripping down the bear's face, catching in the crevices beneath the bear's eyes. Oh, very sad and sweet. I'm standing in my kitchen. Oh, honey. I'm staring at the honey bear's face.
Eileen, thank you so much. Thank you for that poem, and thank you so much for talking with me today.
Yeah, thank you, Brandon. This has been a pleasure.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.